You're good, I said. I'm not that good. I'm just more flexible than most men, which is why I'm so good at being not half man and half woman, but all woman and all man. He sang it out sonorously, even from the floor, and flipped himself upright, putting a hand on me to get his balance. Did you hear Sonny doing my ballyhoo last night? Sonny's a hot ticket these days. You can only see this extraordinary exhibit if you are over 18 or under 80. Under 18, and you won't understand it. Over 80, and you won't be able to stand it. Jerry brought out his radio and stretched his hamstrings on a bale of hay. He found some ragtime. I love the Peabody, he said. He swung me around. This was invented by a big fat guy, he said. That man made the most of what he had, and what he had was more to love. You get me? Jerry took me by the hand. You be the girl, he said. We're gonna rumba. He arched his back and pointed his right leg forward, knees pressed backward, hips high. I stood there, as he must have expected, like an old lady with a mop. He put two fingers on my shoulder and walked them back and forth. He swung around in front of me and put his other hand on my shoulder blade. He took my hand and put it way around his neck. You're around me, and two, three, four, he said, and pulled me toward him. I stepped forward and stopped. Keep going. Right, rock, left. Right, rock, left. I shuffled forward and stopped. He slapped my cheek lightly. Don't be a goop, he said. We're the same height. That's good. He opened a trunk and brought out a bottle of hooch and two coffee cups. What are we celebrating? I said. Nothing. Payday. Your birthday. Any excuse for a little Missouri moonshine. It's not my birthday, I said, although I hated to argue with Jerry even that much. We drank our shots of moonshine. I coughed behind my hand. All I'm saying is, I think we could look cute together. I'm not cute, I said, and I wanted to cry. I wasn't cute. I knew goddamn well I wasn't cute, and if Jerry was telling me to my face that I was cute, it was because something was making him lie to me. Jerry dragged us through a shim-sham-shimmy routine. I learned the names for the flap, the stamp, the stomp, and the shuffle, and I don't think I did a single step right. Looky here. We want you to stay. Miss Paula's cousin's gonna hip-check you off your job when we get to Red Wing. She's a favorite of Mr. Showalter's. I'm trying to find something for you. Well, sure as shit, dancing with you, ain't it? I pulled my sweater around me and stomped back to the wagon. Jerry called out, good night, kiddo. But I knew I had a chance and had fallen smack on my big, fat face. In the morning, I made the flyers for the next town, and Mr. Wilson read my press release. That's the stuff, he said. You tell him what's what with us. You start with a real ass grabber and then give him the facts. They run it like it's news, and ain't we got fun? Mr. Showalter came in. He watched me type for a moment and looked over at Lucius, who shrugged. Mr. Showalter gave the tiniest shake of the head. That night, after flyering in four towns, I came back to my wagon. Jerry left me a note on the mirror, asking if I could come by and help him stretch. Jerry and I did the routines, including the one that opened up his chest. I pulled both of his arms behind him and tugged his left hand up to his right shoulder blade, and then the right hand. It's all about flexibility, he said. Illusion and flexibility. He wasn't wearing an undershirt, and I could see, as I hadn't before, the soft part of his chest, and the hard one. He saw me looking. I don't bite, he said. Neither do they. We are done here, sugar pie. He took me back to his wagon, which was a narrow version of mine, with one bed, a faded patchy quilt, a metal wash basin, and a good mirror bright and clear, with six round light bulbs around it, strung on a cord. He put four biscuits on a metal plate with a little pool of honey and bright red berries, frosted in sugar. Currants, he said. They're so sour, your whole mouth will turn on you. But the sugar makes them sweet and sour. Plus, All those vitamins? We can fight off beriberi. The biscuit was still warm and filled with bits of bacon. I could have eaten bacon biscuits with Jerry all night. It pays to flatter the cook, he said. He pushed his hair back and smiled, just a little. With one corner of his mouth turned up toward his dimple, he looked like a movie star. Do you like my smile? He said. It's a nice smile, I said. Damn right. Anyone can have a nice smile, he said. Within reason. Not every freak, obviously, and not some rube with his two front teeth missing, but you, for example, you could smile. I don't like to. He kissed me on the mouth, and while I was blinking like a clubbed calf, he held my face in his hands. I don't feel like I have so much to smile about, I said, and I was sorry right after I said it. He took his hands off my face and cracked his knuckles. Oh, poor you. I can see what you mean. Here you are, two decent legs, two arms, nice enough pink skin, black curly hair. You can read, write, and type with the parts of the body meant for those activities. You're doing public relations. You got a pair of tits that are really coming along. I see what you mean. You're fucking tragic. Jerry wasn't having it. Carny people punch you in the face before they let you tell them your troubles, and strangle their own selves before they tell you theirs. He lay down on the bed and patted the space next to him. I lay down like it was a medical procedure, and he laughed. I think you can take off your shoes. God love you, he said when I did. Who gave you those shoes? I'd replaced my Turkish slippers with small men's wingtips from the Lost and Found. They were a little big on me, but they were actual shoes. Shiny leather with rubber heels and a sturdy sole. Until Jerry looked at them. I thought only that they were the best shoes I'd ever owned. I'm scared to ask, he said. How about your socks? My socks were plain white cotton, and the only thing wrong with them was that I had to wear them 3 days in a row because I only had two pair. I'm joshing you, he said. Come on and lie down beside your Uncle Jerry, or your Aunt Jerry. He slid the straps of his undershirt down across his shoulders. The right shoulder was muscular and tan. The left was a little softer and whiter. He pulled his undershirt off all the way, rolling it down his body like a tight dress, raising his slim hips to get it off. I sat beside him, trying to see what he was doing without watching. He pulled the sheet aside and lit another candle. The left side of the chest was shaved smooth, right up to the left side's patch of black hair. His whole torso was honey color and firm, his ribs almost raising ridges under the fine skin. See? He said. You want to tell me your story? He can do it now. I didn't want to. I couldn't talk because I was holding my breath. I had no man to compare with Jerry. I'd caught a glimpse of my father once when he was changing his clothes, back before I was scared of him. I saw the pink turkey parts between his legs and thought, that? When the big girls told me about husbands and wives, I thought they were making it up, keeping some more terrible truth from me. His hair down there was dark brown. On one side, he left it tufty and full. He may have even teased it a little. It stuck out so. On the other side, it was a triangle of neat curl, edged like a flower bed. I looked away, and he put my hand on the hair. It's okay, he said. Pretty tame. His penis moved a little under my fingers, and I screamed and put both my hands between my knees. Jerry laughed. He propped himself up on one elbow, and his left breast, the one that was like a girl's, fell forward. It was small. Much smaller than mine, and the nipple was darker. I never had much access to mirrors, but when I was at the O'Neills, I took advantage of their electric light and their indoor plumbing and their bright bathroom mirror. I studied myself. I wasn't thrilled about what I saw, but it wasn't mysterious. Nothing to it, he said softly. Once you know what people expect, you just give it to them. He put my hand on the flat side of his chest. This, he said. He moved my hand to the breast side. Or this. I felt sick. I had never touched a man's bare chest before. I had managed, with some twisting and oh pardon me, to at least brush up against Lottie when she was just in her nightie. I rolled on my side. I laid my hand on his chest. I pressed down on the flat plate of muscle, on the tiny nipple, like an acorn tip. I could feel a few wiry hairs under my fingers. "That's nice," he said. "Nice for me. Nice for you." It was not nice, as I understood the word. Touching his girl breast, which was as close as I was ever going to get to an actual girl, made me sweat. It made me want, desperately, to find a girl at the end of the breast. The other side led to what was really there. A man, with one soft white shoulder, and one thick tan one, and only one small puffy breast. And I didn't want to kiss a man, which I had only just now understood. Every woman I'd longed for, I'd understood to be special. Since I was 9, I told myself that even though, of course, I hoped for a husband someday, these special women interrupted my trajectory, but only briefly, and only because they were so special. Now, I knew that wasn't true. Women were not interruptions for me. Jerry said, "Enough about me." My cami and my knickers were only a little cleaner than my socks. Jerry's gaze was curious and pleasant. I wasn't sure what lust looked like. I tried to imagine how I had looked at Lottie, or even, and my face got hot, how I'd felt when Mrs. Miller hugged me. Jerry pulled on a pair of pink silky knickers. "Let's pretend we're both girls," he said. "I've never been a girl with another girl." I figured that meant he tried all the other possibilities, and my head swam. I lay down, and sat up, and lay down, like a kid with a fever. Jerry sighed, and sat up with me. "It's okay," he said. I thought it might go okay. I thought I saw... not like this. "I'm sorry," I said. "I would. It's like you said, I would like to be a girl. With another girl." "And I'm not a girl," he shrugged. "Well, you're right, I'm not. But hey, let's look at the silver lining. Now you know for sure you like girls, so you don't have to marry a man. You know by mistake." I sat up. Jerry sighed again. He put his arm around my waist and held me still. "Here's what I'm thinking. We get comfortable with each other, and then we try to do a dance number. You do like me, but in reverse. Build up your left side. Use my dumbbells. Get a suntan. Maybe half a mustache glued on. We'll keep one side as girly as possible, so then we could do a tango and trade parts. I'd be the guy, you'd be the girl, and then whammo, other way." I didn't want to perform. I was no more going to tango than fly, and I didn't want to be half boy and half girl. I didn't think I was such a terrible girl that I should just give up being one. I wanted to cry. I wasn't a true freak. I didn't have a talent or deformity that people would pay to see. I was a rube, and rubes were the worst. "No tears," Jerry said. "Forget it. We'll just take it easy." He wrapped his kimono tightly and put his hair back on both sides. I lay back down and pretended to sleep. I studied the quilt. Jerry arranged and rearranged us. He spooned me. He rolled me on my side and made me spoon him. He guided my hand down and moved my hand the way he wanted, and through it all, I pretended to be asleep, and he pretended to think I was asleep. After, I wiped my hand on the underside of the quilt and sat up, rocking in misery. I missed that bacon biscuit. In the early part of the evening, when I thought dawn was going to come and find me and Jerry still talking and laughing. Light broke, and we heard the Rousties taking down the poles and folding up the big canvas. I'd forgotten it was moving day. Jerry said, "Maybe you don't make the move with us. Maybe you head out. You head east, and we head west, and never the twain shall meet." I sat on the bed, tugging at the stitching until it opened and the thin stuffing came out. Jerry slapped my hand. "Oh, no, I'm not having that," he said. "It's time for you to beat it, sugar pie." By the time I stood up, he was dressed and waiting for me to put on my shoes. Jerry walked me back to my wagon. He stuffed my clothes into a small leather valise. He held up $3 to show me and put that in a green silk coin purse. He patted me on the shoulder. I don't want to see your uncoordinated ass still here when the sun comes up. Bus is a mile down the road and coming in 1/2 hour. I skipped over Jerry entirely. For Eleanor. I said that I'd join a circus for a few weeks and learn to type. I said that a man had made advances and I rejected them. And that I caught the bus away from all that to Chicago for high school and on to Battle Creek and the beginning of Lorena Hickok, girl reporter. Eleanor said, as I hoped she would, "You're just so interesting." I told Eleanor what I could. Chicago wasn't terrible. My Aunt Ella was kind. I ran through high school in no time, trying hard to catch up. I overshot and got to college on a scholarship that didn't cover food or clothes. And I did what smart poor girls do. I cleaned houses. I ate the leftovers off other people's plates. And I read other people's textbooks when they left them out on the library tables. I went to any party I could find, and I was first at the bar, and first to dump a bowl of nuts into my pocket. I slept under my coat. I didn't smell great. The life those college people had, the cashmere sweaters and winter gloves, the lined boots and pert hats, were not for the likes of me, and I didn't have the nerve or the discipline to stay. I went to Battle Creek and got a job at the newspaper, thanking Lucius Wilson for teaching me the who, what, where, and when. I told Eleanor I got my first bylines writing about people headed for the Kellogg Sanitarium to eat breakfast cereal and get cured of what ailed them. I stayed just long enough to move into an apartment with a nice girl and her cat. And I didn't mention the girl or the cat to Eleanor. I kissed the girl and went to Milwaukee to start my next life. "More later," Eleanor said. Longing is like the seed. I hustled for the train. Eleanor was already there, waiting for me, sitting very straight in the middle of the seat. She'd kept her hat and gloves on. She looked tired and her face didn't change when she saw me. She sighed. I said that the Potsdam Diner was a delight. She said that after the funeral, there was corned beef and cabbage and homemade beer. She said the service was Irish Catholic and heartfelt. I hung up my coat and made a show of taking out my notebook and doing my job and asking about her husband's ambitions. People said the governor seemed to have a knack for climbing the ladder, regardless of how he'd done on the lower rungs, and I repeated that. "You're very sharp with your observations," she said. She looked at me with those extraordinary eyes, light and clear as a main lake, speckled with deeper blue. "I didn't mean it," I thought. "I don't care. I will praise your husband until my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. I will pretend not to know about the actual duties of Missy LaHand. I will see only what you want me to see." Suddenly, she put both hands on my face, and I still have no idea what she said about Franklin's ambitions. We both leaned forward. "Thank you for listening before," she said. "Thank you for talking." "I'm not done," I said. "And you can tell me anything. It's off the record." "Let's have dinner, and I'll tell you about the beginning and end of my education," she said. The steward brought dinner to our compartment, boiled pork on a bed of watery peas, and for dessert, 2 slices of canned pear, faintly green at the edges. I said it sure was Depression dining. Eleanor said that she approved, that there was no need for frills. That thrills would be abhorrent now, when so many were suffering. I ate my canned pears and thought, "Eleanor, you have never eaten food like this in your life, except when you wanted to." We've told our sad stories, and what is remarkable is not how alike we are in our dead mothers and tragic pasts, but how different Orphan looks from your life to mine. I went out for a cigarette and looked out at the dark blue shapes and deeper shadows racing past. The yellow lights of the train showed more trees, more fields, more track. I came back to the compartment. The plates were gone and Eleanor had pulled down the shade. "No one here but us chickens," I said, and thought that if I could just gag myself, this would go so much better. "My greatest teacher looked a little like you," she said. "She was not as tall as you. She was not willowy. Mademoiselle Souvestre was planted. She had the most magnificent head, like a goddess. White wavy hair, always worn back, like you wear yours. Strong brows, beautiful fearless eyes. Bright Prussian blue. You really do look a little like her. I was living with my grandmother, my brother Hall and I, with her and all her glamorous aunts and uncles. I locked my door every night when my poor uncles were on the warpath, and my Aunt Tissy heard about some of the problems, and she must have dropped every aristocratic name she could muster to get my grandmother to let me go to Allenswood. You know, all the Strachey girls went to Mademoiselle Souvestre, and the Barney girls, and my grandmother gave in. I was 15. It was beautiful. It was in Wimbledon Park, and it looked just like Somerville College at Oxford. It was my Oxford. I barely understood anything she said, except about the wild uncles. "I bet you were lovely," I said.
"I think most 15-year-old girls are," she said.
I didn't argue.
"I have never been so happy in my life," she said. "Ever. I was a favorite. Actually, her supreme favorite. I cannot believe I'm saying that."
I told her I'd been a favorite, too, and she grinned.
"You know, I got to sit next to her at dinner. Every night. I had wonderful friends, too. We all sat together. If you spoke English, a single word, that was a crime, and you might have all of your belongings dumped on your bed. But my French was quite good. Still is. My Italian was passable. Abbastanza bono. My German, well, furchtbar. Terrible."
She thought my clothing was dreadful. She did say that.
She had a very sharp tongue. She was wonderfully witty, but not always kind, and she had a real temper, which I thought would terrify me. But it didn't. I had a friend who couldn't stand it. She was scolded so often, and she left. I watched her go from my window, and I felt for her, but mostly I thought, how can you bear to leave? It made me work harder, to please Mademoiselle. She could shred an essay. She ordered a beautiful red dress for me, burgundy really, for parties and dances. She ordered it for me. She said I should be proud of my height and dress like a woman, not a baby. Oh, I loved that dress.
Her face lit up, and I saw the girl, complete.
Mademoiselle was fierce. She could strip the paint off the walls. She encouraged ferocity. She had no patience with docility. See, just like you. And she took us through a classical education and critical analyses of text and history and the languages and literature. If you couldn't make an argument, you had no place there. And there was no shirking and no laziness. She admired effort and ambition. I'm carrying on, I'm afraid.
I loved her showing off, tossing around the foreign words, letting me see all the pleasure she took in her once giddy, delighted self. I am done for, I thought.
She took me all over France, during the holidays, sometimes just me. Oh, my goodness, it was such a privilege to travel with her. She knew everything. She believed in beauty, in knowledge, and in social justice. She believed in fighting for what was right, even if you lost. and she believed that her girls had a moral obligation to make the world a better place. "Marie Silvestre made me," Eleanor said. She put her head back against the seat. I cried for a month when my grandmother dragged me home for my coming-out party. Mademoiselle argued, I argued, but we lost. We corresponded until she died, 2 weeks after my wedding. 2 weeks after. My wedding gown was pretty, but it was nothing to that burgundy dress.
I would have loved to see you in that dress, I said, and she blushed, and I leaned forward and thought, and we're off. Part 2. Heart of My Heart. Friday afternoon, April 27, 1945. 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. I'm making tuna salad when the phone rings.
Hello, this is Anna Roosevelt Bottiger, Mrs. Roosevelt's daughter. Is that you, Lorena? What are you doing at the apartment?
No one else she knows sounds like me. I sound like the hayseed I am, and the smoker I was, and the drinker that I expect I'll continue to be. Anna asks to speak to her mother, and I say she's sleeping. And Anna says, could you check and see if she's awake? When I don't bother putting down the receiver and pretending to walk down the hall to check, her voice tightens.
Is she sleeping code for she doesn't want to speak to me?
It could be code for that. I certainly wouldn't be opposed to using code like that. She's actually asleep, Anna, I say. There's a long pause, and if I've been wondering how Anna will ask me, who she despises in the most genial terms, to smooth things over with her mother, who she has betrayed, I don't have to wait long.
I was worried. I hardly heard from her since the funeral. That's not like her.
No, it isn't. Eleanor is the one who calls, the one who cares, the one who sits by the sick bed all night. Losing her mother and father, and being raised by a bunch of rich crazies who couldn't find their way out of their own fern and statue stuffed cuckoo's nest, made Eleanor fierce about attachment and control. I wish I'd known her when we were girls. I wish she'd traveled in Europe when she could, with all those glamorous French lesbians and sensible English women, and studied everything she'd wanted to, and not just come home like a good girl to meet and marry Franklin, who was nothing special at the time. I wish she hadn't had so many children and lost the one she loved the best. Some nights, she woke me up, crying for him. Franklin Jr. was 11 pounds and the biggest, most beautiful baby in the world, she said. His smile, she said.
I wish she hadn't had to stand by, mute and miserable, while a parade of Sarah Delano trained nannies and Sarah Delano herself spoiled and scared the children, undermining my darling at every turn. Franklin said that she was lucky to have a mother-in-law who pitched in.
I know Franklin was fun. The children all remembered when he could walk, playing hide-and-seek, at Campobello, or giving piggyback rides through the Hyde Park woods. And no one knew more about stamps and coins, if you like that. Even for me, his reading and reciting aloud at Christmas was a treat. Once at a family party, 2 big scotches, which is how I usually manage, I recited Casabianca. The boys stood on the burning deck, and Franklin and I did the last stanza together, him roaring in with an English music hall accent. Everyone clapped in surprise. He gave me a seated bow, and I gave him the same, from my chair, that was always too close to the fire, but faced Eleanor. I don't blame Franklin. He wanted what he wanted, when he wanted it, like the rest of us. And children get in the way of that. Even when I got to know them as grown people, the 5 of them were still asking for the moon,
looking for handouts and praise and treats every morning. He loved them when they looked good, often, and when they did well, not often. And I don't think he minded that they all fell short, because everybody in the world understood exactly what they were falling short of. The boys watched Franklin, like there was a trick to becoming president, and they could master it and get there. But Anna knew that nothing like that was going to happen to a girl. She studied both parents, and Franklin was the happier one. She saw him roll his eyes when her mother came in with a request, an opportunity to help someone. Never mind that he'd sent Eleanor to research the request, to find the opportunity. Never mind that Eleanor made him look good on the left and gave him wiggle room on the right, his whole political career. "Oh, well, that's my missus," he'd say with a wink to some angry cracker in a white suit. The only thing that mattered to Anna was being bathed in the sunshine of her father's love, and I don't think that made her worse than the rest of them. If her father were Stalin, Anna would have been cheerfully counting up dead Jews and chilling the vodka. Eleanor's love was like some shabby old footstool. Everyone used it without wanting it, and no one ever gave it a moment's thought. "Well, Anna, your mother and I are going through a lot of condolence letters. I hope that sounds like code for, we are bawling the jack, little lady." She sniffs, chilly and disappointed. That sniff is the way she's most like her late grandmother, my least favorite person. "I would rather have sat naked in a steam bath with Franklin than had tea with Sarah Delano Roosevelt." "I'm sorry you weren't able to come to my father's funeral," Anna says, and her voice rises a little. She isn't entirely sure I wasn't there, and all the hustle and bustle, the comings and goings of ambassadors and presidents and friends and enemies and more lesbian civil servants than you could shake a stick at. I can hear she's worried that she just didn't see me. Well, I was very ill, or I would have been there. And I'm here now. I'm giving up subtlety. It's never done anything for me.
"This is such a difficult time. How does my mother seem to you? I mean, she and Tommy tore through the White House packing up like nobody's business."
"You know your mother. Give her a list and Tommy's help, and she'll conquer the world." We both laugh. Once, Anna and I snuck in mile-high corned beef sandwiches and ate them where Eleanor couldn't find us. Anna carried two bottles of Coca-Cola in her bag. I had a tub of potato salad and a flask in my briefcase. Years ago, when I was a young devil, I was good friends with a girl, a painter, and had hopes of sleeping with her honey. The honey had come to my place out of sorts and looking for a good time. She prepared for the good time, drinking three shots in a row and slamming them down the way amateurs do. She passed out on my bedroom floor. I called my friend and she came over. We stood over the passed out girl, two women of the world, as we thought then, and as mad as she was at me and as ashamed of myself as I was, we shared a beer and laughed. Every once in a while, there was that kind of laugh between Anna and me.
"Oh, Hick, did my mother tell you about Warm Springs?"
Her mother had. Her mother had called me as soon as she got back from the little White House in Warm Springs. Eleanor said to me,
"My daughter brought Lucy Mercer all the way to Georgia to be with Franklin. She says she didn't, but I know she did."
She coughed instead of crying.
"I could never betray anyone in that manner," she said. And it was true. She never could.
I could. I had. Franklin could have, and had done, probably five times before breakfast, most days of the week. I told Eleanor that I knew that, and loved her for it. She'd already told me every awful minute she had in Warm Springs, getting Franklin's body back to Washington, and every awful minute after that. Warm Springs was Franklin's great comfort, and his best self. He tried every reasonable and ridiculous treatment on earth, and when he knew he'd never walk again, he tried bathing in the waters that flowed down from Georgia's Pine Mountain, and he moved his right leg a few inches. being one of the world's great con men didn't keep him from falling for the idea of therapeutic waters. He bought that run-down resort in Bullockville, Georgia, for $200,000. Eleanor was horrified, she said, and she had no way to talk him out of it. They were his legs, she said, and he believed. Put in a decent pool in 1926 and made it Warm Springs, and if no one ever made a recovery from the Pine Mountain water, no one ever got worse from it. He gave hundreds of polio victims the chance to be treated and the chance to be seen as people. Some of them were delivered by desperate families, lying on a blanket in the back of a pickup, and some came bundled into a boxcar with just the clothes they wore and a pair of crutches, and to get as much help as they could use. Eleanor said that she loved that he loved it, but it was his place, not hers, his cottage. And she was happy to have Missy sleeping across the hall from Franklin and sitting across from him at the dinner table down there. He was every patient's father, and their friend, and their tireless fundraiser. He was the crippled king, and when he told me that he'd rather spend the evening eating canned ham and baked beans with 2 14-year-old boys from Biloxi, showing him the wheelchair song and dance routine they'd worked up, instead of having cocktails with Claudette Colbert, I believed him. He was their Eleanor. In the last week of his life, he was too tired to visit the patients. Lucy Mercer played hostess. Her friend, Elizabeth Shalmatov, painted his portrait. The Secret Service made their rounds, and the crazy Roosevelt cousins jockeyed for position at the dinner table. Shalmatov's turpentine and Lucy Mercer Rutherford's thick perfume were still in the air when Eleanor got down there. She sat with Franklin's body. I looked at him. I sat alone with him for a few minutes. I kissed him, she said. How could they think I wouldn't know? Do they think I'm a fool? I had to ride in the car with Cousin Daisy, who is a fool, and Cousin Polly. Cousin Polly is a crazy purple-haired bitch, I said. She should have stayed home with all of her stupid dogs. Oh, no. She wasn't going to miss a chance to cozy up to Franklin. And she got to tell me that not only was Lucy Mercer cuddling with Franklin in Warm Springs, but it wasn't the first time, and, oh dear, was she letting the cat out of the bag. But Anna knew all about the whole Lucy thing. That bitch, I said. Please stay away from her, or at least please don't be so nice to her. Lucy Mercer came to the White House, she said, and everyone knew, except me. And you. This was technically true. I'd heard some things, but people didn't tell me what they didn't want Eleanor to hear. Anna wants to apologize, Eleanor said. I know I have to let her, and I know I have to forgive her, but I don't want to do it now. I don't think I can control myself.
Leave it alone, I said. You got years.
Hick, Anna says.
Yeah, Warm Springs. That must have been tricky when your mother arrived.
Anna is not daunted by the likes of me. It was innocent.
If it was innocent, you probably should have told your mother, and then she would have agreed that it was innocent. And then on the day of her husband's funeral, your mother wouldn't have had to postpone her mourning to sit with you while you explained how difficult it was for poor you. All that distressing back and forth so your father could have private time, relaxing time, as you keep saying, with Lucy Mercer. That little buffet of relaxation. And not just in Warm Springs, with no one to watch except the staff and cousins and 40 patients with polio traipsing in and out of the little White House, but even in the real White House and at your mother's dinner table and in the family dining room in front of people who'd been serving your mother, the First Lady, for 12 years.
I told my mother. I told her right away. I didn't know about Warm Springs.
You're full of shit, I say cheerfully. I do like a fight. You chose your father over your mother, and now you pretend you did it out of love. You did it to cement your position, and to give your mother just one more shove to the side. Oh, you kids. You'd run your mother over to get a smile from the old man. And now, who you got? Your mother. And me. I can hear Anna breathing. If Eleanor were awake, she'd kill me. Your mother'll forgive you, I say. You know she will. That's the whole story, right? She'll forgive you for betraying her. Jesus H. Christ, she'd forgive you for much worse than that. And your father would never, ever have forgiven you for not helping him romance the past with a little help from Lucy fucking Mercer.
Oh, Hick, she says. All right.
Turning 50 seems to have flattened my moral high ground, like a great left hook. And I do like Anna. She has always been a fool for love. And I like that in a person. When she was getting divorced and carrying on with John Bodiger, the four of us were a roadshow for romance, even if the two of them didn't know it. She was in love. John was in love. I was in love. And Eleanor was in love with me. Eleanor was always happy to help other lovebirds. If Al Capone had broken into the White House with a hot dame, Eleanor would have hustled them up to the third floor to give them a little privacy. We were all four of us aglow in 1933. Anna bounced on her mother's bed like a kid, crying and laughing about her great amorous adventure, and Eleanor and I pressed hands where she couldn't see. We touched under tablecloths, beneath napkins, behind the newspaper. When the halls were quiet and the maids had gone, Eleanor unlocked her bedroom door for me, and I ran in. It'll be all right, I say to Anna. Your mother just needs a few days. Tell your brothers to take care of themselves. Maybe they can manage not to steal anything or lie to anyone or knock anybody up just for a year or two. You take care of yourself and the babies and John. It'll be fine.
Hick, she says. And I think maybe she'll apologize for the sneers and the looks and the careful arrangement of the seating at parties and the gifts that were calibrated to be exactly or a little less than what was given to housekeeping, and my chest tightens. And I have to laugh at my inner hired girl, always looking for a soft moment with the family. Anna is no more going to apologize to me than Lucy Mercer is going to apologize to Eleanor for sleeping with her husband and betraying their friendship. Oh, these pretty wifey women.
I'd read Lucy's condolence note. I took it out of Eleanor's hand to read it, and then burn it. Lucy Mercer Rutherford sent love and deep sympathy on the occasion of Franklin's death. She wrote that Eleanor was the most blessed and privileged of women, and made it clear that she knew exactly what the blessings were. Lucy Mercer Rutherford had failed to break up their marriage when they were all young and healthy, and she failed again when she was a pretty widow. She showed up for dinner and tea and rides with Franklin in the countryside, and still, she herself would wind up nothing more than a racy footnote, and Eleanor would always be a front-page story in this country. I should know better than to let Anna rile me. Here's one for the books. Your mother sent Lucy one of Shalmatov's little watercolors of your father, and she did it after she got that smug, cruel, unbearable little note. Your mother is extraordinary.
I know, Anna says in her small bird voice. You don't, I say, and I hang up the phone.
I pull the blanket up over Eleanor. I make a pot of Chinese tea and pour two jiggers of gin into it. In Milwaukee, we used to call it Mother's Ruin, but Eleanor wouldn't find that funny. All I care about is getting a little gin inside her so she can rest. She grabs my wrist. Her hair's half down, and she's struggling to wake up, to get from the last grief to the next.
Oh, darling, I keep dreaming about those circus people when you were a girl. I'm glad you got away.
They weren't keeping me, I say. The prissy Eleanor is not my favorite, and they weren't bad.
She says that she can't bear to think of the bad times I've had. I don't say anything. I don't say the two worst days of my life so far have been when my father raped me and that day in the White House 10 years ago when I waited for you from morning till night while everybody watched. I waited so long I ran into Franklin twice and got scalded by his grinning sympathy. Still waiting for Babs? He said. She's somewhere. And he wheeled off to bed. I'd been expecting her since breakfast. I fixed myself up and got my skirt and jacket pressed, always walking that thin line between too much effort, which leads to a Minneapolis matron look, or else the Oscar Wilde of South Dakota, and no effort at all, which is trousers and a sagging sweater, like an old sailor. Eleanor didn't come home until after midnight. I'd gone to bed. She pushed a scented note under my door, and I smelled it before I saw it. I opened the envelope before dawn, and I can still quote the whole goddamn thing. Je t'aime, and je t'adore, and I know you have no wish to make me unhappy. It said that the real task for the two of us was to learn how to love, and let go, and yet keep loving. When I read that, I thought, I am almost 50 years old, and the rest of my life will be love and loss. And when I look down the road, I see a fat old woman and her dog, is what I see. Eleanor reaches for her blouse and fumbles with the pearl fleur-de-lis pin on the collar. She takes the pin off, with her eyes closed, and puts it in my hand. He gave it to me. I'm giving it to you. Another heirloom, from him, to her, to me. She lies down again. I'm asleep already, dearest, she says. Wake me on Monday. I can wait, I think. Swinging on a Star. Friday night, April 27, 1945, 29 Washington Square West, New York. New York. It's hard to believe that the first thing she says to me, over the cheese and crackers and sidecars, is, Dearest Tommy will be here bright and early Monday morning. Early. I won't linger, I say. You're insulted, she says. Damn right. Half and half, I say, and I get a kiss for that. And I'm more insulted by the reward. Like I've mastered sit and shake hands. I could stay on, I say, just to see. Eleanor says, That would be hard on Tommy, wouldn't it? Tommy Thompson's been with the Roosevelts since before me. She lives to serve Eleanor. She'd watch me get hit by a car and grieve only for Eleanor's distress, and my guess is she feels that way about everyone in the world, including her first husband and her current beau. If Tommy comes in to find me drinking coffee in my pajamas, she'll nod and cough. I'll get a half smile. She'll pace around the living room like it's a boxing ring. Hat on, hat off. Finally, she'll plant herself at the dining room table, pull her hatpin out like she's ready to kill Hitler, take her hat off one last time, open her portable typewriter and say, Mrs. R, let's get started. Then she'll go to the kitchen and make coffee that could strip paint. A cup for each of them, and sit there, square as a house, I should talk, while she waits for me to gather up my things, hang up my towel, and go back to Long Island. For years, Tommy and I would find ourselves going to the same meetings, jammed in Franklin's elevator. It was a tight fit. We faced each other. There was no other way. We were square women, standing wide front to wide front, smelling each other's morning coffee and cigarettes. Going up, she usually said. Ladies' shoes, linens, kitchenwares. Secrets of the White House, I'd say, and she'd snort. I walk into the kitchen, which gave me such pleasure to clean a little while ago, and I look for things to break. I don't think Tommy minds me that much. I'm not disloyal like some. I'm not a snob like the Blue Stockings, who make anyone who can't quote Sappho and Catullus feel like a schmuck. I told them Franklin's joke about the sailor and the kangaroo, and changed the sailor to Sappho. No one laughed. I put a bottle of scotch under the tree for Tommy every year, and she's done the same for me. Me and Hick were Mrs. R's right hands, she'd say to reporters, to Franklin, who grinned and bit his tongue, to the relentless Roosevelt cousins, always sniffing for gossip and gold. I certainly don't want to upset Tommy, I call out. Eleanor doesn't say anything, and I walk back to the living room. Only the small lamp is on. She's lying on the couch in her kimono, with her hair unpinned and her eyes closed. Sometimes I get sick of my own self, she says. Likewise, I say. It doesn't matter. She says, the first time Franklin was elected president, when he beat the pants off Mr. Hoover, I cried so hard. I couldn't even greet our guest the next morning. We just met. I was wild about you. I'd never met anyone like you, and I thought, he'll lose, and he'll be governor for a while longer, and who cares what the governor's wife does anyway? I thought, I'll keep teaching, and you and I will be together, all the time. And then he won, and I thought, it's over. It wasn't, I say. I covered Herbert Hoover when he entered the White House, saying, we shall soon, with the help of God, be in sight of the day when poverty shall be banished from this nation. And a year later, stockbrokers were jumping out of windows and farmers were killing their families and hanging themselves from oak trees. The crash pushed on, deeper and harder, and Hoover made a few gestures, like an old lady facing the incoming tide. When 17,000 World War I veterans gathered on the National Mall to cash in their service certificates, I covered the story. They brought their wives and children. They built tar paper shacks Hoover could see from the White House. The Attorney General ordered the veterans driven out, and I covered the story when they resisted. I covered it when American police officers opened fire on decorated veterans of the United States Army, and two veterans died of gunshot wounds. I covered the story when Hoover ordered that buffoon Douglas MacArthur to lead the infantry and six tanks to drive out soldiers who had served their country and needed the money they'd been promised. I covered it when the United States Army burned the tar paper shacks and the veterans left with their wives and children, leaving behind jackets and diapers, cots, pots and pans. The fire stank to high heaven, and when they turned the tanks on the fleeing veterans, I thought, hide, you cowardly tight-fisted son of a bitch. Roosevelt is coming. We were on the story of the Depression every day. Most of us doing our best to record the lives and deaths of people and shame President Hoover. We called old newspapers Hoover blankets and delivered piles of them to the edge of hobo camps. People hitched their broken-down cars and pickup trucks to mules, if they had mules. And Midwestern newspapers ran the photos, calling them Hoover wagons. Hoover made one cautious mistake after another, while people lost their jobs and banks failed every day. 1,000 economists wrote to him, basically saying, don't be a jackass. And Hoover said, the marketplace will sort it out. It sorted him right out of office. Franklin came in on a tidal wave of decency and great speeches. True individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. The country had a leader. Hired girls had a hero. We both showered and washed our hair with French shampoo from before the war. We're sitting on the couch in our old terry robes. I say, we look like a pair of polar bears. Eleanor says, I've never stopped loving you. That's what I was trying to say. I know, I say. Likewise. You know what I've always loved about you? No, she says, as if she can't recall. I always loved when you walked into one of Franklin's late-night soirees with Princess Martha tossing her curls at him like she was on the piano at the Norwegian box top, and you just clear your throat. That's all you had to do. And they all froze.
She clears her throat to make me laugh. I loved that. I did. They just stopped on a dime. You pocket their balls and walk out. I loved that. Every time.
Did I seem like a nag?
I wouldn't call it nagging. It was like having the Statue of Liberty watch you have one beer too many. Everyone except Franklin would shrink a little, and Eleanor would purse her lips as if she was so clobbered with disgust she couldn't hide it. When I wasn't the victim, I loved it. And when I was the object of her love, when her eyes lit up across the room, when she touched her fingertips to the pulse at the base of her throat to mark the spot for me, to mark herself, I thought that there was no sacrifice I wouldn't make. Eleanor leans forward, and the strap tears off from her slip, and we both hear it.
That slip's done, I say. I'm glad.
She pulls it off, and I unbutton my shirt. I let my robe open, and our tired white flesh meets, and what may not look beautiful does feel beautiful. Eleanor says that we should turn out the light, and I say, I will pay you $1 million to let me look at you. Every woman's body is an intimate landscape. The hills, the valleys, the narrow ledges, the riverbanks, the sudden eruptions of soft or crinkling hair. Here are the plains, the fine dry slopes. Here are the woods. Here is the smooth path to the only door I wish to walk through. Eleanor's body is the landscape of my true home. The words the happy say. Saturday, early morning, April 28, 1945. 29 Washington Square West, New York, New York. I wake up before dawn, and Eleanor's in the living room, glasses on, tea steeping. She smiles up at me.
More letters, Missy's nieces, and her brother too.
I liked Missy, I say. I never felt so sorry for anyone in my life.
I know. Poor Missy. Good heavens, Princess Martha's arrival. Missy deserved better.
We both roll our eyes, and Eleanor pushes back an imaginary hat with two fingers and wrinkles her nose at the same time, making her a perfect naughty rabbit, or, if you knew her, a perfect Princess Martha of Norway, Franklin's frequent guest.
You were very good to Missy, Eleanor says.
I was. 4 years ago, it was warm but not yet hot, and Eleanor was traveling for weeks. I was rabble-rousing for Democrats, and Missy was in charge of the White House staff party. She wore a nice black crepe dress with a lace collar and only a little pink lipstick. Like Eleanor, she was a study in beautiful gray and white, and unlike Eleanor, her dress clung top and bottom. Eleanor always arranged for corsages for the female staff, and Missy's was just like Eleanor's, a cascade of three white orchids. I always thought she looked enough like Eleanor to be a younger sister, with better teeth and a stronger jawline, but no one else in the world seemed to have noticed, so I didn't say. Franklin rolled into the party, wearing a chef's hat and apron, and everyone clapped. He turned on the twinkle and served up a few plates. He winked at Missy, patted me on the arm. Missy's done it up, he said. Too bad the missus couldn't come. And wheeled out. Missy called for three busty girls to get up and do their version of the Andrews sisters, and I said to Grace Tully, if I hear, by mere bis du shang, sung one more time by girls who wouldn't kiss a Jewish boy if his life depended on it, and Tully, Franklin's junior secretary, shushed me. Missy put a finger to her lips to scold me, and then she clapped both hands to her forehead. She grabbed at the buffet table and brought the tablecloth, the plates, the petite boar tower, and the bowls of fruit down around her. Oh, she kept saying. Oh, God. Oh, God, have mercy. What is this? She said. Her lips turned blue. Tully grabbed her by the belt going down, and I knelt down to catch her. In 20 years,
Missy sometimes had a few too many drinks, which was mostly her wish to keep up with the boss, and also, and I have no high ground here at all, her wish to periodically forget that he was the whole world for her, and she was a delightful little village for him. I thought this might be only that.